West Virginia had one of the highest opioid-involved overdose death rates in the country. This landmark trial is the first legal test of the argument proposed in more than 3,000 other lawsuits nationwide that the nation's largest drug distributors fueled an epidemic of addiction and could set the tone for future litigation related to the crisis. In Minnesota, Attorney General Keith Ellison and state prosecutors are seeking a more severe sentence for former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin after a jury found him guilty in the murder of George Floyd. In paperwork filed with the judge on Friday, Attorney General Keith Ellison asked for a, quote, aggravated sentence on behalf of the state. Without an aggravated sentence, Chauvin could end up serving a minimum of 2.5 years for his violent crimes. In making his case, Ellison cited several factors. Those factors include Floyd's vulnerable position on the ground, the presence of at least 4 children, and that Chauvin committed the crime as part of a group of, quote, 3 or more persons who all actively participated in the crime. In immigration news, the United States will begin reuniting migrant children with their parents this week, according to Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas. 4 families that were separated at the Mexico border will be reunited in the United States this week in what Secretary Mayorkas says is just the beginning of a broader effort that will stretch on for months and possibly years as separated parents are brought back to the United States from around the world. More than 1,000 families remain apart, according to the Department of Homeland Security. The parents were deported alone, mostly to Central America in 2017 or 2018. Their children, however, have since grown up with relatives across the U.S. Immigrant advocates welcomed the announcement, but expressed frustration at the slow pace of reunification. 3 Colorado police officers have resigned after video surfaced of their arrest of a 73-year-old white woman last June who was slammed to the ground and handcuffed. Karen Garner, who suffers from dementia, sustained a dislocated shoulder, a fractured arm, and a sprained wrist. Another widely circulated video shows officers laughing while watching footage of Garner's violent arrest. Garner has filed a federal lawsuit citing violations of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 82 degrees and mostly cloudy. In New York City, it's 71 degrees and partly cloudy. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Amara Evering.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and I'm in the Shawnee National Forest along with Romero Funes, the assistant producer of Sojourner Truth. We are in southern Illinois, and we're participating in the Resurgence, North American Forest and Climate Movement Convergence, which is taking place right now, Shawnee National Forest. And by the time you see this and hear this, it would already have happened October 11th. through 14th, 2019. And the organizers say this is not a conference, but it's a call to action. It's really spending time to plan for the future. And I'm really delighted to be sitting here with a panel of people who are very, very connected to the land, people who work on the land, who are doing farm work and have been wanting to do this for quite some time. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. And I'd like to welcome each and every one of you. And you can just say your name, the organization you're from, and also where you're based.
Hi, I'm Dennis Connolly. I'm with the Shawnee Forest Defense, and I live 20 miles west of here on Rattlesnake Ferry Road near Snake Road and bordering 2 national wilderness areas.
I'm John Zippert. I'm the program director emeritus for the Federation of Southern Cooperatives Land Assistance Fund at our Rural Training and Research Center in Epps, Alabama. And the Federation is a regional organization working with black farmers and other low-income people in rural communities across the South. The Federation of Southern Cooperatives is a member and part of the Rural Coalition, and I'm also a board member and actually the chairperson of the Rural Coalition Board. And our coalition is a national coalition of people, mostly people from distressed rural communities, people who have been historically underserved and in some cases discriminated against by agencies of the U.S. government and state governments.
My name is Barbara Shipman. I am a member of the Rural Coalition Board. I am also the director of the Cottage House Incorporation, which is located in Ayrton, Alabama.
I'm Stephen Bartlett from the Sustainable Agriculture of Louisville and the U.S. Food Sovereignty Alliance, which is a national alliance of people directly frontline communities and support organizations working to defend the right of small farmers and people of the land and rural peoples to have a good life and to have a well-compensated life and to have the rights to produce what they like and have a good living. So,
actually, Barbara, it's just starting with you, if that's okay. Tell us a bit more about Cottage House, but also coming to this conference, focusing on the environment, on, you know, knowing everything that's happening in the world with climate change and everything that goes along with it. Tell us why you think it's important to be here and what are the issues being discussed here that is of concern to you and the work that you're doing.
In Cottage House, we're located in rural Alabama. We have youth programs there because I'm located in an area where there is no more smokestack industry. We lost that years ago when we had Russell Dress Company, then Hughes Shirt Company, and Martha Stewart, West Point Pepperell, and made all the towels and linen for your beds. So when these companies left our area, our school closed, and our kids had to be bused over counties to another school, as well as all of that infrastructure, stores. So what we were left with, just an empty shell, whereby we had to create what we wanted in our own neighborhood. So through the College House, we were able to pull our youth together, train our youth how to grow their own food. We train the adults how to grow their own food. A lot of people live in a rural area, but they just did not grow their own food. So we know how important it is to eat fresh, good, healthy food. And that is what we focus on, the next generation of agritourism. We also look at what the future is going to be for our young people. So it's very important for us to focus on training our youth how to grow their own food. And we know that we have to create just what we want in our neighborhood, which is agritourism. We did that, and it helped to bring income into our neighborhood, so people were gainfully employed again, and people were happy about living in the rural area, because most people living in the rural area own their own land, and they did not want to lose their land or their home. So that was one of the things that we were instrumental in doing. Another thing is we look at being involved with other organizations. So I'm on the board of directors with the Rural Coalition, which ties me to other communities just like my community. And we work together on issues and come up with different ways and means of solving our problems as a group. Also, coming here to the Convergence, it gave me a broader look at what it is to have that land, to own that land, and to care about that land and the love of the land. We have a forest land. And it's very important that we keep as many trees as we can, and we're looking at the carbon from that. And that's very important to know that you do have something that has a great asset added to it. And our trees is one thing that once they're gone, it takes 50 to 100 years to grow a really, truly sound sturdy tree. And so if we start cutting down all the trees, getting rid of them, there aren't going to be any trees left for shade or the wild plants, the wild herbs that grow on our land, and the water that flows through our land. We have a problem with climate change that affects our land. And being here at the Convergence, you know, it just opened my mind to more ideas that we can implement on our land and make sure that we keep that land, and also teach our young people the importance of keeping the land, staying on the land, and utilizing that land not only for farming but for tourism as well. So it's a win-win situation for me to be here and sit through all the classes and to learn more about the different things that we can do to save our environment, because it is very important that it is here for us. Thank you.
Okay, Stephen, we'll go to you next. And I wonder, from you're with the U.S. Food Sovereignty Alliance, Sustainable Agriculture. You're based in Kentucky. A lot of our listeners, when you think of Kentucky these days, well, unfortunately, a lot of people think, oh, Mitch McConnell territory. We do know there are a lot of very good people in Kentucky really trying to do a lot of very, very good work. From where you sit, though, what are some of the issues, the problems you have had to grapple with as a result of environmental devastation, or even if you think it is as a result of environmental devastation? Stephen Bartlett.
What's very clear to a lot of us is that the economic inequalities and the marginalization of communities according to their race and their class, their income, is directly related to environmental issues. Because those communities, not only are they victims of, you know, being marginalized, redlined, having low incomes, having no source of employment, they also located where there are very industries with heavy toxic output. So if you go to Louisville, Kentucky, you will notice that the west side of the city is predominantly low-income African-American community, and that's where all the big industries that are polluting the air are located. It's also where there are food deserts or places where you can't get healthy food, and where transportation is difficult because people don't have cars and they can't drive a long distance to get to a supermarket. Food desert is a place where, because of transportation and location, you aren't able to easily get access to healthy food in an ordinary grocery that would have healthy produce. So what we've had to do in Kentucky, in Louisville, is find a way to connect the local farmers, because Kentucky still has many small farmers due to the tobacco supply management program of many years that helped kept the price for tobacco up. When that program went out of existence, many farmers nevertheless were able to diversify and bring food directly into the city. However, it was hard to get that food into the low-income neighborhoods. So the Community Farm Alliance and an organization called New Roots has been struggling for a number of years and came up with a kind of organizing model that has been very successful in bringing healthy food into low-income communities, which is called Fresh Stops. And that's like a week advance CSA purchase that communities buy. They leverage their buying power for wholesale CSA community-supported agriculture, where you order ahead of time food from a local farmer. And in this case, there are about several farmers who are supplying the food to these fresh stops. There are now 11 fresh stops. One or two of them are rural. One's in Lexington, Kentucky. The others are in Louisville, Kentucky, in low-income neighborhoods. And what that brings is very healthy food, organically produced, at a price that poor people, low-income people, can handle, either $12 per basket of food, or $6 if they get a double dollar. And others will pay $25, which helps subsidize the lower income. So this is fresh produce of all kinds, potatoes, corn, all kinds of vegetables. And during these fresh stops, which are kind of like pop-up markets, they people also get demonstrations on how to cook the food. And so this is a program that's been, you know, it's a big problem everywhere in communities across the country. Even though this, the United States, is supposedly the most powerful and wealthy society in the world, nevertheless, people are suffering from terrible health issues and lack of access to healthy food. So, the U.S. Food Sovereignty Alliance that we're a part of has organizations from urban centers as well as family farmers in rural areas, even commodity farmers who are producing corn, beans, soybeans. We understand that small farmers have to be involved in solving the climate problem, the climate crisis. We say small farmers cool the planet and feed humanity. And that's the case around the world. Most of the food that people actually eat in the world, 80 or 90% of it, comes from small farmers. What you have here in the United States is large commodity producers, and much of their food is not destined for human consumption. It's going to feedlots where animals are mistreated on an industrial scale. It's going to ethanol production. It's going to exports where they're turned into processed foods and sent across the world to feed animals in unhealthy situations, unhealthy model of production. So we're fighting against the industrial agriculture, and we think they are responsible for at least 40% of greenhouse emissions, maybe 50%. And we see a direct relationship between bringing back small farmers and fighting climate change.
John, you have been doing this work for quite some time. You're based down in, you're in Alabama? My goodness, I was just reading an article just this morning, actually, about Alabama and the progress or lack of it, so to speak, in Alabama since the civil rights era. And they were giving examples of what has happened in Georgia, a black woman running for governor and getting close to it, and even progress in places like Mississippi. And then there was a question was, well, what about Alabama? Right. What is going on in Alabama? But John, perhaps you could fill us in a bit on that. And in particular, I know that you have worked with black farmers. There's so many black people from the South, not only Alabama, but across the United States, who had some pieces of land in the Reconstruction era, the post-slavery era. So many who have lost that land, and there've had to be big battles to hold on to that land. I want you to talk about that, number one. And number two, I've also been reading that there is now a reverse migration happening of black people who had left the South going to northern cities, and now there is a move of some of those black people returning to the South. John.
The Federation of Southern Cooperatives has three main things we've been working on, and we were started in 1967 by 22 cooperatives that came out of the civil rights movement. One of those I worked with in Louisiana, Sweet Potato Marketing Co-op. Those 22 co-ops formed the Federation of Southern Cooperatives in 67. So this is we just celebrated our 52nd anniversary, and we're going into our 53rd year. And I'm emeritus. I have retired, but I'm still volunteering. There are three main things we work on. One is helping black people to retain and utilize their land in a productive and sustainable way. Secondly, we organize cooperatives as a way to give individual small farmers and small people, in individual people, the strength and the economies of scale that larger enterprises have. The third focus of our work is on changing public policy from the federal level, the state level, and the local level to benefit rural communities. On the issue of, you asked about land, and land is a major focus of ours. And actually, 100 years ago, in 1920, black people in America owned 15 million acres of land. Coming out of slavery, people understood the importance and the value of land as a way to make a living and feed themselves. In 1960, it was down to 6 million acres, and today it's about 3 million acres. The other part of that problem is that 40% or more of the land holdings of the people we work with are held as heir property. So grandpa died 20 years ago without leaving a will. And everybody in the family, all of the siblings, their children, everybody has an undivided interest in the land. And this creates problems, because if you want to farm the land and if you want to get government credit and government assistance, you have to more or less have the consent of everybody. And recently, the Rural Coalition, which was also mentioned, through the Rural Coalition, we were able to put some provisions in the 2018 Farm Bill that help people with heir property to certify themselves with the government. Better ways of proving that if you're farming, you are the person farming, and you can get some of the government benefits. But this heir property situation had also resulted in the loss of land, because you now have 20 or 30, sometimes more than that, people who have an undivided interest. An unscrupulous person can come to Chicago or Los Angeles or wherever and buy the undivided interest of one of the heirs with a quit claim deed. Then they come back to Sumter County Courthouse and they demand a public sale of all of the land to get their undivided interest. And so this has resulted in the forced sale of a lot of black-owned land. Now, you mentioned the idea of people coming back home, and we do see that, and we do support people. The Federation gives help to people, who want to come back and start farming, beginning farmers, new farmers, veteran farmers. We work to give those people assistance, and really technical assistance as to how to best access government resources. And I am here at this convergence because most of the people I work with own less than 100 acres of land. And they, about half of their land is in woods, in forest. And we try to help people to see how they can come up with a forest management plan. And then we assist them in, we do in, encourage and assist them in harvesting the timber that they could harvest sustainably and then to replant. We're also encouraging reforestation with longleaf pine, which was the original tree in the Southeast Crescent. And we help people to think about harvesting pine straw and selling that, raising mushrooms, and also engaging in what's called agroforestry. We're encouraging people, for instance, to raise goats, because the goats in the forest will browse and forage and eat a lot of low-hanging things that are in the forest and plants that grow between the trees. So, and then we're encouraging people to raise goats. We're actually importing goat meat in this country, and we feel like we could raise enough goats to satisfy that need. So I could talk on and on. I've been working on this for 50 years.
Okay, so thank you. Thank you so much, John. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and you're listening to a panel of people who are very, very connected to the land, people who work on the land, who are doing farm work. We are in Southern Illinois, and we're participating in the resurgence, North American forest and climate movement convergence, which is taking place right now, Shawnee National Forest. And by the time you see this and hear this, it would already have happened October 11th through 14th, 2019. And the organizers say this is not a conference, but it's a call to action. We'll be right back. Stay with us. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you've missed any part of this hour from 10 this morning for 90 days after that, just go to kpfk.org, scroll down to archives, click on Sojourner Truth. You'll be able to hear the show in its entirety, and you can check us out on our website at sotrueradio.org. If you're on Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. We're also on SoundCloud. Look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And today, we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the state of Alabama, and internationally to our SoundCloud listeners in France, where there was a recent uprising in France. On Twitter and Instagram, you could find our handle at So True Radio. Dennis Connolly, you are from this area, not too far from here, with the Shawnee Forest Defense. And two things I'd like you to talk about. One, the work you're doing, the kind of farming that you're doing, and if you have had to make any adjustments over the years, given what's happening with the climate. And secondly, about the Shawnee Forest Defense.
Yes, on our farm, I specialize in turmeric. And and the kale and collards that we ate today.
Turmeric, very popular these days.
Right. And I grow three varieties of sweet potatoes. And I have a small orchard, all disease-resistant trees, and a number of them are from PRE, which is Purdue Rutgers U of I developed for disease resistance and low spray maintenance. Mm-hmm. I'm also developing, and not developing, but planting a pecan grove. So each year I plant maybe four pecan trees. And this year of nut trees, I've started to get butternuts. So they will come. It's a long-term strategy, or it's just enjoyment. I enjoy planting trees and watching it grow, and we live in the bottoms. And so other trees I'm planting are cypress, because we have floods. And so the changes in the environment. So this year we basically had a long-term spell with no rain. So what I'm doing is buying bales of straw, and you can buy a large round bale around here for $25. And then so mulching is key. So I've mulched and quite extensively this year, and that's also keeping the weeds down. And another crop that I grow, I've got a field of asparagus that I should be harvesting next year. Mm-hmm. So I'm diversifying our farm. And the reason I came to the convergence.
Are you organic or?
Oh yes. Oh, I'm not certified organic. I don't feel this $750 dollar fee is is worth it. But I can say since
You practice it, you know.
Correct.
But, yeah.
And I sell less than $5,000 to the co-op, so that I can, so legally I can say that I am organic, and I've always been organic, and have. My parents were born in 1910, and my mother was raised on a farm, so she taught me how to garden.
Where was she raised?
In Grand Ridge, in LaSalle County.
In
Northern Illinois.
Northern Illinois, okay.
And she could farm with two or four horses, and so she would basically know by instinct, basically, when to plant. And she would get my father out there. He would spade. She would make the rows, and I would put the seeds in, like radishes and carrots and lettuce. And I can remember doing this starting at the age of five, and I just got hooked. And at six, I was spading. And my father would do most of it, but I just really enjoyed growing things, you know. And so I'm continually doing that, and I've always had a garden since I was a lad.
Are there any farms close to where you are that are not organic or perhaps are using GE seed? The reason I'm asking is I've read stories about the wind blowing genetically modified or, you know, seeds or whatever that are spread that are not organic onto organic land, and that creates a bit of a crisis.
Right, and I've been paying attention to this for a few years. There is one farmer in our valley, and this year he has not planted anything. So in the years that he plants corn, I don't plant corn. So, but I've noticed he goes from corn to beans, and he just has a small acreage. And but this year he did not plant at all. So this year I grew Cherokee Eagle, so there's no contamination that I know of.
Cherokee Eagle
corn.
Corn, okay. Yeah.
It was developed by the Cherokee Nation. And so I was able to grow this over the years, and we're saving our seed and passing seed on to Stephen.
I saw a precious bag of seed yesterday.
And that was seed that we grew.
That was seed that you grew.
Correct.
Yeah. Just looked amazing. Corn seed. Yeah.
And I grew it this year. And it's okay. An amazing crop. Even with so I made three plantings this year. And this year I'm trying a different, it's not strategy, it's indigenous wisdom with the three sisters, with the corn, the bean, and the squash.
Oh, okay.
And so I'm not planting it in rows. I'm planting it in circles. Mm-hmm. And it's an and so next year I will, plant maybe not so I not as wide of a circle or not as tight as a circle, but I'm gonna plant more climbing beans, and so that also keeps the raccoons out because there's too much. Entanglement, and they don't like that. And they also, the raccoons don't like high plants. Like right now, the latest corn patch has pumpkins, and they like to be able to stand up and see if there's any prey coming. And so I've noticed that last circle that I planted, there's very little raccoon damage.
Oh, so, take that.
Yeah.
A natural way of dealing with our friends, the raccoons.
Right. Yeah. Brother raccoon,
brother
can,
raccoon.
Can be an interesting character.
Yes. Personally, they scare the hell out of me, but that's another story. Right. Yeah. What about Shawnee Forest Defense?
So Shawnee Forest Defense, this is a group of, we just started. And originally we were RACE 30 years ago. That was the Regional Association of Concerned Environmentalists. And we took the Forest Service to court and got an injunction and had the longest running forest injunction, timber cut injunction in the United States. And so that went on for 18 years. But that injunction has been rescinded. And so now this is a second battle we have with the Forest Service, and we are.
Why was it rescinded? Do you know?
Because originally the supervisor and the forestry, they were not legally keeping up with their plan. The Forest Service has to put out a plan, mm-hmm. and they were not at all following their own plan. And we read the plan, and they were doing clear cuts. They were not replanting, mm. and they were not maintain what they call maintenance. But they weren't very good forest stewards, and so we challenged them, and now we're challenging them again.
Okay.
And it's an ongoing battle, and it's currently happening.
And protecting this beautiful place. This
Correct.
Is the Shawnee National Forest that we're sitting in right now that you are working, you and others,
right.
working to protect.
And it's a national forest that we all own, which is an interesting concept. If you, uh-huh. you know, it's not a private timber yard, but the Forest Service is really misleading. They call themselves Forest Service, but they're not really even servicing the forest. They're servicing the timber industry at a loss, which is incredible. So wow. each timber sale is a loss. And so years ago when we protested their $20,000 timber sale would cost them $200,000 with... because they would have to bring in the police, and they would have to bring in extra security, and all, and their bulldozers,
yeah.
and they literally brought in a bus, you know, to take out the protesters, but they never used it. It was very much intimidation.
You have to be mobilizing yet again, Barbara Shipman. Back to you for a moment. I wanted to ask about. Women farmers. We don't see a lot or hear a lot about or from women farmers, but we know they are women farmers. Also, we know that farms that basically are run or owned by men, that often they're women, perhaps a partner or a wife or something, you know, that really makes it possible for that farm to continue and make tremendous contributions to that farm. And I'd like your thoughts on this.
As far as women farmers go, we have women farmers who are members of our cottage house industry. Well, women farmers are truck drivers, they are reefer truck drivers, which are the reefer means the refrigerated trucks, and we have our own refrigerated trucks, and when we grow our produce, we grow together, and we sell together, and we help each other out. And we have women who are tractor drivers. They know how to connect, hitch up the farm equipment, and these women have inherited the family farm. They are keeping those family farms alive. They are also teaching their children, both the boys and girls, how to maintain and do everything there is to do on that farm. And for us in the South, a lot of our women are the head of the household. They're single women. And farming is a way of life. We're very proud to be farmers, and we love what we do. We love the land, and we just enjoy what we do. And we also know that you can make money with your farm, because when you understand how co-ops are structured, how group interactions are structured, then you are just a win-win person for our organization, because we do have a large number of women who do farm. They own that land, and they own large acreages of land as well. So, and they've inherited it through their own family, or they married a guy who owned land and maybe passed away, and they want to keep that land in the family because we're not getting any more land. Once we lose our land, we don't get it back. So we encourage all of our farmers, both the men and the women. This is an asset. Land is an asset. Land, you can use it in many different ways. You can borrow money against that land, raise a crop enough, and sell it. You can pay off that loan and still maintain your land. So we encourage that. We talk about it, and of course, with all the programs that are there through, and the help that is there for us through the cooperative, The Federation of Southern Cooperative, they have helped a lot of women and men to maintain that land. And that's what it's all about. You own the land, keep it. Mm-hmm. Pass it on to the next generation. And then we teach them that. And it's very important to let our children know that, hey, they are not poor. Mm. Because if you own land, you are a wealthy person.
And Stephen actually wanted to pick up on the question related to women farmers, but also on something you said earlier. Now, the women's network that I'm part of, we did a lot of work during the UN Women's Decade. And globally, one of the figures that came out was something like in Latin America, I think it was 60% of the agricultural work was unwaged, done by people, but they're not getting like a traditional wage, perhaps payment in some other form. In other parts of the world, including on the continent of Africa, the percentage was even higher. In Europe, the Green New Deal for Europe has an interesting call in it. In it, they are calling for something called a care income. And they say people who are working on the land, who are taking care of the environment, who are raising children, taking care of older people, and doing, you know, work that makes the whole society survive, that there should be a care income from that. And then some people are saying, well, where should that money come from? Some people are saying, well, how about reducing military budget? But the other side of it, and looking at the data, we also know that even that unwaged caregiving work produces a lot of wealth, trillions of dollars, in fact, according to the ILO and other UN organizations. So that's wealth that's being produced, but not wealth that is necessarily coming back into our communities. And in Europe, they're making the case that a care income would really help that as part of dealing with the environmental crisis. And I wondered your thoughts on that and some of the challenges in terms of payment and resources for people who do agricultural work and who work on farms.
I think what you've described, Margaret, is true, and it's really a symptom of the way the economy has extracted wealth from people who do this kind of labor, but without compensating them sufficiently or fairly, right? We believe that governments should support small-scale farmers, and they should support women who tend the land and raise children. We feel like healthy home life, you know, is an asset to the whole society. I was just in Venezuela with a delegation, bringing seeds to farmers who have had trouble now buying their seeds because of the blockade that's been imposed against Venezuela by the U.S. government. Most of them are women farmers. And this was in the high Andes Mountains where they're growing vegetables. They couldn't make much of a living if they had to wait on the middlemen to come and buy their produce in the high hills. They got a very low price for their produce, and there wasn't a lot of incentive and motivation to work hard and produce a lot, given that they were always being exploited by intermediaries who would buy the produce very cheaply and then sell it at a high price in the city. What organizers that we met, and most of them were women organizers as well, have done is because they saw the crisis of hunger. They were experiencing hunger in 2015 when the sanctions began to come into effect. So they went back to their home province, and they started organizing the farmers there. And they got them into a network, and then they linked them with organized people in the cities who are part of cooperatives and what they call communes in the cities, in the low-income neighborhoods of Caracas and other cities. And they connected the farmers and the consumers, the eaters in the city. The base of the revolution, a lot of the support for the revolution that led to this that has really improved life for millions and millions of Venezuelans has been in the cities, the support that the government has had. And so those city people were in desperate need. And the farmers then planned, they coordinated together, they planned what they were going to grow for the people in the cities. And then they put together their trucks and they put together a distribution system. And the price now, this food is coming into the cities from these rural areas, and it's the price is 20% of what it is on the ordinary market. Because the wealthy people who controlled the food in Venezuela, the importers, have always gouged people. They've always raised the price. But the Venezuelan people at the grassroots now have found a way to provide healthy, low-income, low-priced food in the cities. And it's women who have been organizing at every level. We saw women growing an acre of cilantro and peppers and combining it with other farms next door to be able to send this food. And they're paid immediately for the food, and they know exactly what they're going to be paid. And this has been a great stimulus to the farmers. And it's a new model that's growing in the midst of this very terrible crisis. We in the United States, they've asked us to try to end the sanctions, try to pressure our government against the sanctions and against the blockade. It's illegal. It's like trying to starve a whole people. It's like a collective punishment because they wouldn't do what the United States wanted them to do, which was to open up their oil to the U.S. oil companies. And so it's all connected to this fight against climate change, because if the people can't control the resources of the oil, then that oil will continue to be used for militarism, for corporate greed, for waste, terrible, wasteful society.
That's quite amazing, and we hear nothing about this being reported in the mainstream media in the U.S. And it's interesting because Venezuela was one of the countries after the UN Women's Decade where a resolution was passed that says governments have to start counting and valuing unwaged work that's done in the home, on the land, and in the community in Venezuela. They use that resolution and pass an article called Article 88 that is in their constitution, where they actually began an experiment where the lowest income mothers would get some form of an income.
I agree that the UN has also put together, the millennial goals, and Venezuela was the country that succeeded in all its millennial goals ahead of schedule. But none of these advances and achievements of the Venezuelan Bolivarian Revolution, which Hugo Chavez brought in and then Maduro is continuing to support, have been talked about. Only they've been labeled in a complete lie that this is an undemocratic tyranny, and it's not. It's just that they've become the boogeyman for the United States because they're a bad example, quote unquote, of people actually having true autonomy and democracy in their country.
And John, just looking at the clock, we're running so short of time, and we'll have to get back to each and every one of you so that you can have a bit more time to talk about your work. John, I hope somebody's writing a book about what you have been up to. But John, I also wondered if you would comment a bit about the impact of poverty and just trying to make it as a farmer with a population of people that you have been working with.
I live and work in the Black Belt of Alabama, which is about 15 or 20 counties that go straight across the central part of the state of Alabama. And I guess Selma is the capital of the Black Belt and the capital of voting rights in this country. I live about 75 miles from there. The Black Belt of Alabama, and it comes from the fact that this was an area of significant cotton plantations and slavery. So actually a number of these counties have still a black population majority or close to it. But they're also some of the poorest counties in Alabama and among the poorest counties in this whole country. And so poverty is a significant issue for us, that not so much for the farmers, but for the people living around them. Some, I think, with our work, we've helped the farmers to do better. But the people living around them are still suffering from really a pot in for a family of four in Alabama, $20,000 is the poverty level. Many of these people are below that, so they have poor education, poor housing, and other quality of life that accompany the poverty. And I just wanted to go back to something else. You asked about the role of women. That our effort with farmers is for the family farm. The family farm means the husband, the wife, the children. So we do a lot of work with women. That's in the Federation. In the Rural Coalition, we have been working also with farm workers who are, these are the people who harvest the crops, who raise the food, who harvest the food, who are among the most impoverished people and exploited people in this country. And in fact, many of them do not have documents. And so there's a real serious problem in this country with farm workers, farm worker women. There are women involved in farm work. So, you know, talking about other programs, there's a whole segment of the Rural Coalition that's addressing this whole question of farm workers, farm worker women, and their rights and the need for more support and resources for the poorest people.
Dennis, I did want to go back to you for a bit. I was hoping to catch up with Dean Kendall. I might. Who is a subsistence farmer in Pennsylvania, and he has been doing a different kind of farming, he said, in relation to the soil and soil regeneration, that kind of thing. But I've heard, I think it was you, Stephen, and you might want to comment on it, who said that small farmers will help to cool the planet. Is that your view as well? And if so, why?
I believe that is the case. And I've currently started reading a book called The Holistic Orchard by Michael Phillips. And he's going into detail about not what's above the ground, but what's below the ground, the microorganisms and the mycorrhizae, and with mulching and planting different things like nitbone, comfrey. And the comfrey sends a root down, and then it draws up the nutrients like phosphorus and potassium, and then when it dies, it lays that phosphorus and potassium as mulch on top of the ground.
Wow.
And then the roots are able to take that up, so I don't have to buy fertilizer. I don't buy any kind of commercial fertilizer, but I do compost. But it's just a fascinating concept that I'm just learning. And worms also bring up all this wonderful nutrients from the ground.
Yeah.
So if you have mulch and different plants there, you get all this wonderful subterranean life and with growing, and the trees are actually healthier. And I'm seeing no disease in any of my trees, but I did start with cedar rust resistant trees on all my apples, and the pears are all fire blight resistant. So I started with a great selection of trees, and a number of them are from past generations. Like there's one from called Aunt Rachel that's out of North Carolina that was only on one farm that was discovered in the 1800s.
Oh my goodness.
And so this kept alive. So some of the trees I buy from Century Farm Orchards, which is an interesting place to go to, and I highly recommend that
right.
place for trees.
So what you're really describing is that there's a whole underground life that we know likely very little about. And just when you said that, it just gave me chills, because I'm looking around at all of these trees and thinking that right underneath the soil, there's probably a whole web of who knows what, communication, assistance to each other happening among these trees, like a tribe, right? Or a family. It's just amazing. Well, we're out of time, and we're going to have to leave it there, but I really want to continue this series, because increasingly we see such a divide between those of us who live in the cities, those of us working in the rural areas, people like yourselves that are feeding the rest of us and are helping to cool the planet. And the kind of fascinating thing about this convergence is the coming together of farmers with people who are forest defenders and other people all working together on this. It's just marvelous, I think. We are out of time. Today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, assistant producer Romero Funes, and of course, our engineer, Mr. T. Teddy Robinson. If you'd like a copy of today's show, contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Amara Evering with some brief news headlines. The Biden administration has approved a major solar energy project in the California desert that will be capable of powering nearly 90,000 homes. The Interior Department said in a statement today that the $550 million Crimson Solar Project will be built on 2,000 acres of federal land west of Blythe, California. The announcement comes as President Joe Biden has vowed to expand development of renewable energy projects on public land. This is part of a broader agenda to fight climate change and create jobs. The project will include a battery storage system and will be sited on land designed for renewable energy development by the Desert Renewable Energy Conservation Plan. And the Environmental Protection Agency is also taking a major step today to battle climate change with the formal proposal of a rule phasing down the use of planet-warming gases called hydrofluorocarbons, which are used in air conditioning and refrigeration. The reduction will decrease HFC production and use in the U.S. by 85% over the next 15 years. Unlike many of the administration's other climate initiatives, there's a broad bipartisan support for curbing hydrofluorocarbons, which are thousands of times more potent greenhouse gases than carbon dioxide. This will be the first time the federal government has set national limits on HFC. More than a dozen states have either banned HFCs or are formulating some restrictions. In immigration news, President Joe Biden formally raised the nation's cap on refugee admissions to 62,500 this year after drawing a wave of criticism from supporters for initially keeping the record low cap of 15,000 set by the Trump administration. The president noted the, quote, sad truth that reaching that number of admissions this year will be hard to achieve by September, given the challenges rebuilding a system President Donald Trump has dismantled. Biden reinforced his goal of 125,000 for the fiscal year that starts in October, but cautioned that number will, quote, still be hard to hit. Facebook's independent oversight board said it would issue a ruling tomorrow morning that would determine whether former President Donald Trump can return to the company's Facebook and Instagram platforms. Facebook was among several social media platforms that suspended his accounts following the January 6 attack on the U.S. Capitol. Chief Executive Mark Zuckerberg has said the suspension was important to reduce the risk of violence through the inauguration of President Biden. The company later referred the suspension to the oversight board as the company grappled with how to treat one of its highest profile users after his exit from public office. Students at an Arizona high school have been disciplined after a short video of them reenacting the murder of George Floyd, which began circulating on Twitter. The 6-second video posted last week shows a child kneeling on the back of another student's neck at Highland High School in Gilbert, Arizona. The Twitter post says that a black girl was in the classroom at the time of the reenactment. In the replies, people condemned the racist incident, but added that this type of behavior is common at this school, according to Arizona Republic. Yesterday, family members and civil rights leaders mourned Andrew Brown Jr.'s death at an invitation-only funeral. The event was held 2 weeks after Andrew Brown Jr., a black man, was fatally shot outside his North Carolina home by deputies serving search and arrest warrants. the event was as much of a call for justice as a goodbye. Speakers included Brown's sons, as well as civil rights attorney Ben Crump, who was representing Brown's family, calling Brown's killing a, quote, unjustifiable, reckless shooting. Crump told mourners the legal team would continue to fight for justice and transparency. In his eulogy, the Reverend Al Sharpton issued a powerful call for the release of body camera footage. This call comes a week after a judge declined to do so. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 78 degrees and mostly cloudy with high chance of rain. In New York City is 70 degrees and partly cloudy. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Amara Evering.